John Cleary with you. Good to be back. Noel DeBien's also along. November 12th, on this coming Wednesday, Baha'is around the world will take the day off work, if they can, to celebrate the birthday of Baha'u'llah, their prophet, who was born in Iran in the 19th century. The Baha'is count some 17,000 members in Australia, a significant number of whom fled to Australia as refugees after the Islamic Revolution of 1979, when the Ayatollah Khomeini took power in Iran. Well, Dr. Natalie Mobini is an Australian-born convert to the Baha'i faith, and Noel chats with her about her path to the good life.
I'm Natalie Mobini, and I'm a Baha'i.
Natalie, welcome to the program. The good life is about lots of things, and I'm interested to ask a Baha'i, because I know Baha'is are in the news a lot because of the situation in Iran. We hear about that all the time. Certainly the government of Iran seems to want to do its best to get rid of Baha'is. There's been a lot of trouble there. Why?
Well, Noel, the Baha'i faith is a new religion. It was founded in the mid-19th century, and to the Islamic government of Iran, it's viewed as a heresy because it postdates the Prophet Muhammad, who is usually seen as being the final of God's messengers.
So effectively, Baha'is get it in their neck pretty much as, I suppose, Christians get it in their neck in Iran from time to time.
Well, the Baha'is are actually in a worse situation because the Christians are recognised as people of the book. Muslims regard Jesus as a divine messenger, but because Baha'is came after Muhammad, they're viewed as heretics, and many Baha'is since the Islamic Revolution have been executed or otherwise life has been made very difficult for them.
It's sort of a funny thing, because when I think of the Baha'is that I've known, my family come from the northern part of Sydney, and I grew up seeing the Baha'i temple at Ingleside there, the big domed white structure, and everybody knew it as a landmark in the area, and we'd all been up to visit it, and every Baha'i I've ever met seems to be an extremely sort of moderate, easygoing sort of person. My cousin sends her kids to Baha'i classes because she thinks it's very tolerant.
Yes.
Now, how does that figure with being an atrocious heresy that needs people to be arrested and people have actually been killed in Iran? How do those two things fit together?
Well, it's very difficult, really, to put it together. I look at the Baha'is who I know who have come from Iran as refugees, and as you say, they're wonderful people. They're people who really make a contribution to the community, and you wonder why any government would want to remove that element from its society. But it really comes down, I guess, to fanaticism. If you lived in Iran and you didn't know any Baha'is, the picture that you would get from reading something in the newspaper is that we are a group that works actively to undermine the government, that we're a conspiracy of the Americans or the British or the Russians or whoever happened to be the enemies of the moment. And it's totally alien to what the Baha'is actually are.
Now, it actually started in Iran, didn't it?
That's right, yes.
That's the point. So that's why the trouble is within Iran, inside an entirely Muslim nation, as it were. This is where the Prophet arrived. Now, tell me about the Prophet. You lead the good life because you believe that there's been another Prophet. So who is that?
Well, that's right. Well, his name is Baha'u'llah. He lived in Iran, passed away in 1892, and came, of course, from an Islamic Shiite Muslim background, but proclaimed himself to be a new messenger of God who brought a message of peace and oneness of humanity. He was exiled for Iran for those reasons and remained a prisoner for the rest of his life, eventually passing away as a prisoner of the Ottomans in Acre. That was a prison city at that time, now part of Israel, and that's another piece of ammunition that gets used against the Baha'is in Iran, because our world centre is in Israel. It's purely a fact of historical circumstance.
Ah, so Baha'is are somehow allied to Israel and the state of Israel as well. Is that the way it's perceived in Iran?
Yes, that's the ideology. In fact, the leadership of our community was arrested in Iran just coming up to 6 months ago and have remained in detention ever since. and no charges have been laid against them, but the government prosecutor has spoken in the press and said that they're arrested because they're agents of the Zionist regime, which of course is nonsense. Baha'is don't engage in politics.
Well, in a way, we couldn't talk about the good life in Baha'is without at least mentioning all of that, because that's so much in the news that Baha'is are under persecution. It's raised in the United Nations, etc., etc.
Yes.
But of course, the good life, this segment is about what it is that people do to lead the good life, what brings well-being. Now, I'm looking at you, you look completely Anglo-Irish Australian or Anglo-Australian.
Yes, that's right.
Even though you've got a Persian name there. How do you end up a Baha'i? What drew you there?
Well, I became a Baha'i nearly 20 years ago. I came across Baha'is at university. And I guess the thing that originally attracted me to Baha'i was that it offers a way of reconciling the existence of all of the great religious traditions without having to choose one and deny the rest.
Because it says all the great leaders are prophets, Muhammad, Jesus, Buddha, this is all acceptable to a Baha'i.
That's right. It's all seen as being part of the progressive revelation of God's will to humanity through different people at different times. And we see the Baha'i faith as the most recent, but not the last in that series of chapters, I suppose, in the God's divine book. And so originally that was something that attracted me and also intrigued me, because of course you immediately think, well, how can that be? How can you maintain that when there are many differences between the religions? But I found when I looked into it and when I spoke to Baha'is that the point is that when you go to the fundamentals of those great faiths and what they teach us about how we should behave towards God and towards each other, then there are many, many similarities, and that's what Baha'is look to.
You were doing, I think, Islamic studies at university, weren't you?
That's right, I was. I majored in Indonesian history, and I'd read the whole Quran at that point, actually. I'd learned enough about Islam to think, well, I don't think I really am part of this nominal Christian heritage that I received, if it means denying any validity to the truth of that message.
So you were actually from a Christian background, you read in Islam and the Quran, and said to yourself, well, this is not wrong, I don't feel that the Quran is wrong, and you ended up a Baha'i. What's the leap?
Yeah, well, I guess what happened really was that when I started to read the writings of Baha'u'llah, the founder of the faith, it seemed to me to be true. There was so much that was good in it and so much that I responded to, and so you reach the point where you ask yourself, well, am I just going to sit on the sidelines and say, oh, very well, or am I going to play an active part in something which gives me an opportunity to work towards making the world a better place? And I guess I took that leap of faith and became a part of it.
So it is a faith conviction for you. Baha'i, you came to the conclusion, this is a true prophecy, this is a true religion. I feel
that. Oh, absolutely. Yes. I mean, that's what you need to do if you're going to become a Baha'i. And I think with any religion, when you convert, it's a matter not so much of recognizing a set of truths, but a source of truth. And I saw in this a source of truth. And I remember there was a particular moment I had been reading Baha'i writings, and I came across a passage that says, seize thy chance, for it will come to thee no more. And I just felt, it was one of those moments where I felt it was really speaking to me and saying, you know, well, you can look and see what's wrong with the world, or you can actually leap in and try to do something to fix it. And that's the path that I took to do what I can, I guess.
So for those of us who are not very familiar with the Baha'i faith, is the focus on this life or the next? Is there a heaven notion and a hell notion among Baha'is? Or is it about good works here?
Well, there's certainly an idea that this world is not all that there is, that there is a world beyond, or worlds upon worlds. For a Baha'i, there are two purposes in life. The first is to know and love God. And the second, which really arises out of the first, is to contribute towards an ever-advancing civilization. And in the process, we develop the qualities, the attributes that we will need to take into the next world. But the point is not that we're doing it for some divine reward, we're doing it out of love of God.
So the good life is about the advancing of civilization. Is that a key thing for a Baha'i?
Yes, I suppose it is. Yes, we have a view that ultimately world history has a direction, and that it's a positive direction. That
it's linear, it's not circular like the Hindus. It has an end point, does it?
Yes, we would see the establishment ultimately of a kind of abiding universal peace as being an end point to that. And there are many steps along the way that ultimately at this time involve the recognition that beyond our nations and beyond religions and beyond races, all of humanity is essentially one. And we believe we're leading towards a global civilization in which that's a value that will truly be recognized and established with justice.
I'm interested to talk a little bit more about the characteristics of the Baha'i Faith as they show themselves in the way people lead their lives. Now, Mobini is, I think, a Persian name. How do you come to be Natalie Mobini?
Well, I married a Baha'i of Iranian background who came here, as many did, as refugees following the revolution in Iran.
79, I think it was. The Shah lost his throne, wasn't it?
Yes, that's right. Yeah. Yes, that's right. My husband came to Australia in 84 and we met sometime after that. And Baha'is are really very much encouraged to look beyond our superficial differences, you know, and mixed marriage, if you'd like to call it that, is something that's really actively encouraged.
I read that actually the Baha'is encourage interracial marriage. This is seen as a good thing, as a unifying thing.
Yes, absolutely. And very much the alpha and the omega of the Baha'i faith is unity. So whatever brings unity between families, between individuals and ultimately between nations is something to be worked towards.
Now, another thing I was reading as I was preparing for this is gender equality.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you're Dr. Natalie Mobini. I know you've got children too, but I expect that this gender equality issue will also be quite central to you in your marriage, that there's a clear understanding between husband and wife of the equality of people, even if there are slightly different roles.
Yes. Oh, absolutely. The principle of the equality of all people, which includes within it the equality of men and women, is really a foundational principle of our faith. It's one of the things that I guess is most remarkable about it, given the fact that it arose in this cultural background that was not one that really supported the idea of equality.
And before universal suffrage, I think, in the West as well. We're yes. talking before universal suffrage, before women got the vote.
Yes, yes, absolutely. And so we're very much encouraged within our marriages to take a consultative approach and to recognise that there are times when each partner will need to give way to the other in order to have harmony, but there's certainly not the idea that one is the decision maker. And within my marriage, I have two children aged 8 and 5, and we've certainly had times where I've worked and where my husband has looked after the children and vice versa. These things we try to share as equally as we can.
A modern Australian marriage. But a Baha'i model, I suppose.
Yes, I guess you could say that.
When it comes down to what the Baha'is do as an organisation, when I was reading that gender equality issue, the issue of world unity mm-hmm. and the advancement mm-hmm. of civilisation, mm-hmm. those things have practical outcomes, don't they? Because I've seen quite a lot of lobbying done by Baha'is, submissions put in, suggestions to United Nations, to government on various issues. What sorts of issues would the Baha'is of Australia involve themselves in?
Well, it's something that we do very carefully because the principle of unity being so important, we don't want our approach to society to be one that adds to division. So we actually stay right away from partisan politics.
I know you're not allowed to be a member of a political party, are you?
That's right, that's because we yeah. see the partisan political system as being essentially mm-hmm. divisive, one that sets people up against each other. Whereas we feel that if you're going to get anywhere, you need to start from a point where you're actually bringing people together. But Baha'is in Australia have been particularly, active, in areas of anti-racism work, reconciliation, equality of men and women. We're actively involved in the human rights area. But the way that we tend to approach that, rather than taking on specific issues, is to go back to the foundational principles and say, what is it that we can offer, starting from the basis that humanity is one and we are all equal, that will provide a way forward in all of these areas.
Were you involved in the so-called queue jumpers and all the issue of mandatory detention and these sorts of issues?
We didn't get involved in the area of actual criticism of policy or policy proposals. What we tried to do was go back to, as I said, to foundational principles, to the idea of the oneness of humanity, to international law and international declarations, and to see a way forward based on those things on which we can find some common ground and common agreement. But our approach is never one that takes to the streets.
We're not likely to see a Baha'i street protest with shouting and banners and Molotov cocktails?
No, well, certainly not the Molotov cocktails. If there was an issue that's a matter of principle, like, you know, there's a peace parade or something, or walking over the Harbour Bridge for reconciliation, we're happy to get involved and actively get involved in that kind of thing. I mean, even in cases in Iran where the lives of Baha'is have been at stake, the community has never resorted to any kind of violent, aggressive response to that.
The good life for the Baha'i involves a moderate emotional approach. It involves some sort of detachment. Am I getting that sense?
Yeah, I think both of those things are true. Moderation in all things is a bit of a catch cry for Baha'is. We feel that you should be very much engaged with society and that we should enjoy all of the wonderful things that creation has to offer us, whether it's food or whether it's fine art or beauty or whatever it is, but we shouldn't become attached to it. I think that's the important point. That's the difference.
Is there such a thing as a Baha'i aesthetic, a sense of what is beautiful?
It's probably a little early in the history of the faith to really say there's such a thing as a Baha'i aesthetic. Certainly beauty is something which is valued, harmony is something which is valued, and it's believed that the role of the arts are to uplift the human spirit. So from that, I guess you'd get a sense of the direction that a Baha'i artistic approach would take and the one that it wouldn't take. But it's very much open to individuals to bring to it what they understand and to bring to it their own cultural background. It's a universal faith. It's found in countries all around the world. And it's expected that diversity is valued, and it's expected that will give rise to a rich array of understandings and manifestations of the faith.
I ran into Baha'is on Thursday Island in the Torres Strait. I remember years ago doing a filming piece there for the ABC and running into the Baha'i Centre on Thursday Island, so I don't doubt you. Now, the Ingleside Temple, though, is quite well known for its choir, its musical production, because I'm struck by the music I've listened to off the CDs. In fact, let's just take a little bit. Now that piece, Allahumma, a God, it's in Arabic. How does that happen?
Well, the sacred writings of the Baha'i faith are in Arabic and in Persian. Baha'u'llah revealed different texts in both of those languages. Allahumma is really an invocation of God.
Now there's plenty of English music, though, English language music being produced as well. I presume there's going to be a lot of varieties of language if Baha'is are everywhere.
Oh, absolutely. And we've made a point of actively trying to have our sacred writings translated into as many languages as possible to make it something that's open and accessible to everyone.
Dr. Natalie Mabini, thanks very much for joining us on The Good Life.
It was a pleasure.
Well, let's go out on a piece in English from the Ingleside Temple Choir of the Baha'i Temple, God Sufficeth.
Say God sufficeth. All things above, all things, and nothing in the heavens or the earth, but God sufficeth. Verily, he is in himself the knower, sustainer, the omnipotent.
Say God sufficeth.
Say God sufficeth, all things above, all things as God's in him, the heavens or the earth. Say God sufficeth, heavens or the earth. God's in him, he is himself, the
sustainer, the omnipotent.
Music of the Baha'i tradition. Noel Debien and The Good Life.